Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. I'm Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and in this episode, I'm going to provide a sort of digest version of the PMENA conference in Reno, Nevada. PMENA is the North American chapter of the International Group for the Psychology of Mathematics Education, and they hold a research conference every fall in various locations across North America. I used to be on the steering committee for PMENA, and I was one of the organizers of the 2019 conference in St. Louis. It's my favorite conference, and so I'd like to share a few quick summaries of the plenary presentations and a couple of the research sessions. Before I get started with my summaries, I should say that PMENA, although it has psychology in the name and has a psychological history, it is now pretty open to various kinds of research in math education. I also want to give acknowledgments to the conference organizers in Reno, Taruni Lamberg, Diana Moss, Glenn Waddle, Linda Weist, Rachel Welder, Heather Crawford Ferry, and several others. I know it's a lot of work putting on a conference like this, and it's a great service to the field. And one of my favorite things about PMENA is that they publish legit proceedings, which are freely available online. You can find all the past proceedings at pmena.org. All right, so let me describe a few of my thoughts and recollections on the plenary presentations. The opening plenary was by Mitch Nathan and James Middleton. Mitch Nathan is a distinguished professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's in the Educational Psychology Department. He talked about how math learning should be meaningful and that meaning often comes from the real world. There are metaphors and embodied experiences that are connected or mapped over onto the mathematical realm. He talked in depth about these two realms, the real and the mathematical, and he pointed out that math is unreal, it's ungrounded, and it's abstract. We want students to A, master the rules of the unreal world, and also B, we want students to feel comfortable in the unreal world, like they are true residents of the math realm. But math education, as it's currently constituted, focuses very much on A, on the mastery of the rules. And we just hope for B, the comfort and the feeling like a resident. We hope for that without really building it up. We have students master the rules, master the rules, master the rules, but we don't give them opportunities to feel comfortable, like they truly belong in the unreal math realm. Nathan talked about work that he's doing with Candace Walkington and others to try to build meaningful learning for students. And he laid out three approaches to try to build that comfort and feeling of legitimate residency for students. First, he talked about progressivism from Bruner, which is like moving systematically from concrete to the abstract. Second, he talked about professional vision from Goodwin, which is sort of like helping students to see the abstract realm through the eyes of an expert, like taking up the discourses and the visions of people who are well-established residents there. And then third, he talked about immersion in micro-worlds. He cited Otmar and others. And that involves like playing around with graspable math or exploring the unreal world and just exploring it and starting to notice the patterns and the rules from firsthand experiences in that unreal world. So those were some of the main ideas from Mitch Nathan. His plenary also included some remarks and some songs that were by James Middleton from Arizona State University. Middleton has an engineering background, and he's the former director of the Center for Research and Education in Science, Mathematics, Engineering, and Technology. Middleton talked about math education needing to have more engagement, and we need to recognize the multifaceted complexity of emotions. And he also played two songs on guitar and singing. With the first song, he made the point that you don't necessarily have to be good to try, to be engaged. Math is like music. You can have fun and feel connected and get a lot out of it just by doing it. It doesn't matter if you're the best at it. And then with his second song, he talked about needing to engage people in diverse ways. He wondered if we could draw some lessons from the Barbie movie, which seemed to engage a lot of people across different age groups and cultural backgrounds. So that was the opening plenary. On day two, there was a plenary with three scholars. Lisa Lunny Borden was first. She's from St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. And Dr. Borden shared about her ongoing work with Indigenous elders, building relationships with them and asking them to show me your math, and centering their ways of thinking and doing rather than coming at things from the perspective of the traditional European curriculum. Dr. Borden had a guiding framework of expectations, elder knowledge, ethics, and epistemology. And she gave several examples of how to use math to explore and understand the world in community with Indigenous people. If you're interested in her work, I encourage you to check out her project, which I believe is called Connecting Math to Our Lives and Communities. Next in the second plenary was José Luis Cortina from Universidad Pedagógica Nacional in Mexico. He talked about a multi-year project that was focused on an instructional sequence for five-year-olds. The instructional sequence was about number and patterns, like early number 1 to 10, but the point of the presentation was not about the instructional sequence itself. It was about how his team has adapted in the way that they work with teachers to promote the instructional sequence. At first, they had a fairly ambitious and involved approach to the instructional sequence, and there was one particular teacher who did really well with it. The students in this teacher's class were really enjoying math and getting into it, learning a lot about the numbers, and the administrators of the school noticed how that was working really well. So they wanted to try to share this success with other teachers. But that sharing, that spreading of it, didn't really work. The teacher couldn't really spread it to her colleagues, and the project team that was led by Dr. Cortina didn't really do well spreading it beyond this teacher either, even though they could see that there was really this positive potential of the instructional sequence. In the presentation, Dr. Cortina emphasized that it was important to avoid the temptation to blame the teachers for it not spreading, or to blame the school context for the failure of this instructional sequence to take off. Instead, they had to look at their own program and try to improve their approach to the PD. So as a project, they made some substantial changes. And then, things actually did start to spread. I think he mentioned that after they made these adjustments, their Facebook group for the early number instructional strategies now has more than 7,000 followers. So how did they turn things around and really promote the spread of their ideas? Well, he laid out three important principles. First, they had to tweak the instructional strategies so that they were viable in the teacher's current classrooms. Second, they had to share the instructional strategies in ways that were easily recognizable by the teachers as something that the teacher understood and was relevant to them. And third, they had to make sure the instructional strategies were designed in a way that teachers could engage fruitfully in those things right from the start. It couldn't be something that was so complex that the teachers struggled at first, only with some promise that in the future it will get really great. There had to be a high likelihood of immediate success. These three things together, Dr. Cortina said, helped spur the improvement and the spread of their instructional sequence. Now, I was very excited to hear about this work because it connects directly to an ongoing project that I have with Zandra DeRajo, Amber Candela, Paul Juan Savage, and a group of grad students. We've been following a version of these same principles, although we didn't know about Cortina's work yet, but we have been following some similar principles and we're trying to build something that we call incremental PD for teachers. Although Cortina was working in the elementary space, we are trying to design practice-driven PD for algebra teachers. But our ideas are basically the same. We're trying to suggest instructional changes that fit within the teacher's current constraints and connect to their current teaching practice. We are trying to design them to be easily graspable by the teachers, and we are looking for instructional changes that lead to feelings of success right away, because teachers already have a lot going on and they don't need PD that just makes things harder for them. In our project, we are trying to empirically investigate the features of these instructional suggestions and which ones are likely to get taken up by teachers. We call those high uptake practices. But that will be a topic for another episode, because to finish out the plenary from day two of PM&A, there was Teddy Chow from Ohio State University. He talked about the importance of stories, but then he recognized that math often has fake or contrived stories, like those proverbial word problems. Improvements have been made by culturally sustaining pedagogy, which brings in objects, pictures, and stories from students' real cultures. And then going even further than this, Dr. Chow shared examples from his ongoing work where he has been working with students to empower them to tell their own math stories using digital tools and multimedia. He talked about the importance of digital media literacy, and he shared the practice of digital math storytelling. Digital math storytelling involves students finding some math in their daily life, drafting and sharing a video story about it, adding and then expanding on their first draft, then creating a final video story, and also building community by having a public screening of those digital stories, which helps to empower and solidify the students' feelings of being math storytellers and having a voice. Teddy also had some very cool AI-generated images in his presentation, so he was spurring us to think in a modern way about how math fits with today's younger generation and with the technological tools that are zooming around us. So that was my perspective on the second plenary. There was also one more plenary at PM&A in Reno, and this one focused on the idea of mathematical play. Amy Parks from Michigan State and Melissa Grisolfi from Vanderbilt got things started by describing a school that they're working with in Nashville to set up a playful culture in the school. With regard to mathematics, this means play that is specifically designed towards some math learning goal. And it involves creating exploratory spaces for math learning, which are fun, but not just fun. Again, there's a learning purpose behind the fun. Dr. Parks and Dr. Grisolfi talked about the Playful Learning Project, which involves PD with teachers, observations of student interactions in their classrooms, and an ongoing video club where the teachers and the project leaders can collaborate together as a community of educators. This Playful Learning Project happened to coincide with some nice increases in the test scores at that school. And they said the test scores going up, that was not the purpose of the project, but it was a happy occurrence that the test scores went up because it contributed to feelings of trust from the school, and it gave the teachers more freedom to continue with the playtime. The playtime didn't seem to be taking away from academic performance. If anything, it might have been enhancing it. Next in the plenary, they played a short clip of kids playing an animal-based counting game. Then they invited a series of panelists to react to that video clip from a variety of theoretical perspectives. Nathaniel Bryan from UT Austin was the first to react to the video clip, and he talked about the framework of Black Play Crit. He pointed out the Black boys in the clip and how they were supporting each other in playing and exploring their ideas in a form of brotherhood. And he talked about the harm that comes, especially for Black boys, when people police and restrict their play. Naomi Jessup was next. She's from Georgia State University, and she used a framework of anti-deficit noticing. She talked about the importance of seeing children as full human beings, allowing them to explore their creative ideas, and also making interpersonal relationships central to the learning. She talked about culture and power in the classroom, and how play can be a way to disrupt the teacher's normal dominance in the room. Tran Templeton from Teachers College Columbia was the last to react. Templeton talked about the value of listening to kids about their social lives and honoring the complexity therein. She also pointed out the openness that the kids exhibited with each other in the video clip, and she talked about a critical childhoods framework where we have to try to see kids on their own terms and not just through our adult point of view. So overall, this was a very unique plenary, and I appreciated the focus on play. It isn't my area of expertise, but I do feel that play, especially play with a purpose, has a very important role to play in formal education. And I also hope that schools keep or reinstate recesses, because even unstructured play, I think, is important. Oh, and one other thing about this third plenary. Amy Parks is not just a math ed researcher, she's also a young adult novelist. I read her book, The Quantum Weirdness of the Almost Kiss, and it's really good. It's mathy and it's funny, and the lead characters are really well drawn, especially the clever female protagonist, so I encourage people to check that out. Okay, so those were the three plenaries at PM&A in Reno. Of course, there were also a bunch of posters and dozens of research sessions, so I won't even try to give an overview of all that stuff, but you can find most of it in the published proceedings at pmna.org. And I will say that I had a poster there on trying to learn from anti-conspiracy theory research and trying to incorporate that stuff into instruction for mathematical reasoning. That's something I'm hoping to work on in the future, studying whether math reasoning can help inoculate young people against bogus conspiracy theories. And I also saw a session with some instruments in development that may be of interest to people. So Kathy Hall-Cross, Holt Wilson, Robert Hansen, and Allison McCulloch, who are from UNC Charlotte and UNC Greensboro, they're working on a survey version of Chuck Munter's interview protocol around teachers' vision of high-quality math instruction. The new survey instrument for teacher vision will be more versatile than the interview, and they had some good validation results around the math task dimension. But it's proven to be kind of tricky to validate all the levels of the role of teacher dimension. The other instrument was by Offer Romero Castro and Laura Van Zust from Western Michigan University. They're working on a really cool survey instrument about teachers' perceptions of students with disabilities. They want the instrument to help inform PD efforts that are moving beyond integration to true inclusion of students with disabilities in math class. The survey involves teachers' views on disabilities as well as teachers' views on students with disabilities, and it has some well-formulated scenarios that teachers can react to. They're piloting the instrument now, and Castro spoke very passionately about all identities being part of the human experience. And so I think we should keep an eye out for that instrument and think about ways to make sure our work is inclusive of students with differing abilities. But those are just a few of my thoughts and summaries. I'm going to wrap it up now, but I encourage you to look at the PMNA proceedings and to reach out to any of these scholars to learn more about their work. And if you want to participate in the next PMNA conference, it will be held in Cleveland, Ohio, with a proposal submission date of mid-February. Thanks for listening, and I have just two quick announcements before I close this episode. One is that you are welcome to submit your own summaries of research in math ed that you can send to ottensam@att.net. And if I get some summaries of research that people are reading or thinking about, I can put those together into a future digest episode. And then second, if you are graduating soon with your PhD in math education, and if you're interested in pursuing a research career in math ed, or if you know someone, or maybe you're advising someone who's graduating soon with a PhD in math education, we invite you to consider applying to a postdoctoral position here at the University of Missouri in Columbia. We have a posting for a future faculty postdoc position, which means it's a 2-year postdoc that's specifically designed to support someone in their research agenda, and then that position will flow forward into a tenure track research position. The position is actually open for math educators or science educators, but I assume it's mostly math educators listening to the Math Ed podcast. Mizzou is located here in a vibrant college town, and our math education group is very active with 6 faculty members: myself, Corey Webble, John Lannon, Chuck Munter, Tiffany LaCroix, and Natalie Pugh. And we also have an awesome doctoral program with about 10 full-time doc students who are wonderful collaborators on our courses and on our research projects. We're excited about the prospect of adding a researcher through this postdoc opportunity, and we're also trying to see if we can hire a teaching professor as well to balance things out in our program area. So if you're interested, the due date for applications for the postdoc is November 1st, and you can email me with questions, or you can go ahead and submit at missouri.edu. I'll put a direct link to the application portal in the show notes.